From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama draws a possible agenda for NATO as it applies to Russia and the Ukraine. We'll hear from VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns. Russia's president comes out with a plan of his own. And Somalia's government speaks out on a U.S. drone strike on its territory. It's all ahead on International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. President Barack Obama condemned Russia's intervention in Ukraine Wednesday as a brazen assault on the country's integrity and assured three former Soviet satellite states that NATO would defend them against any aggression by Moscow. Mr. Obama said that Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia had lost their independence before to Moscow, but that with NATO, you will never lose it again. The American leader spoke to a crowd of about 2,000 people in a concert hall in the Estonian capital of Tallinn after meeting with the leaders of the three Baltic states that joined the U.S.-European military alliance in 2004. Mr. Obama declared that NATO would be resolute in defending the three Baltic states on Russia's western border.
First, we will defend our NATO allies, and that means every ally. In this alliance, there are no old members or new members, no junior partners or senior partners. They're just allies. Pure and simple.
NATO agreed in 1997 to not position its troops on Russia's border, but Mr. Obama said that declaration will be open to discussion at Thursday's NATO summit in Wales because circumstances clearly have changed with Moscow's involvement in Ukraine.
It was not the government of Kiev that destabilized eastern Ukraine. It's been the pro-Russian separatists who are encouraged by Russia, financed by Russia, trained by Russia, supplied by Russia, and armed by Russia.
Mr. Obama announced plans to send more aircraft to the Baltics as he seeks to reassure nations on edge about Russia's military involvement in Ukraine and possible Russian threats to the Baltic states. The U.S. president also said all NATO members must do their fair share of defense spending in order to bolster the alliance. Mr. Obama held up Estonia as an example of how all 28 NATO members must fulfill their pledges to contribute 2% of their gross domestic product to the alliance. At the summit, Mr. Obama joins the leaders of the 27 other NATO nations for a conclave aimed at sharpening Western support for Ukraine as Kiev battles a months-long rebellion by pro-Russian separatists near the Russian border. The summit is set to focus on proposals to establish a rapid reaction NATO force capable of deploying quickly to Eastern Europe. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko is due to attend, although Ukraine is not a NATO member. Russia has voiced strenuous opposition to any NATO presence near its borders, and Tuesday said it would review its military strategies if, as expected, NATO members endorse the creation of the force. Joining us on International Edition is VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns. Scott, President Obama is on his way to Wales for a meeting of NATO. What are we expecting here?
On his way to NATO, President Obama in Estonia today said that the NATO alliance needs to help strengthen Ukraine's military and said the alliance needs to leave open the door to new members to counter what he called Russian aggression. Now, you'll recall the potential NATO membership of Ukraine and Ukraine moving in other ways toward a closer economic alliance with Europe is one of the factors that has motivated Russia to take these actions, to be concerned about the future direction of Ukraine. So far, the Western response has been sanctions. The president has taken some criticism for that from some of his domestic opponents, saying that he's not done enough. In Estonia today, the president said that Russia is paying a price for its intervention in Ukraine. He said the capital is fleeing, foreign investment is plummeting, and he's working with European leaders to stiffen those sanctions to further put a price on Russia's actions in these eastern provinces of Ukraine.
Do you see or can you judge any kind of motivation for the NATO members to move beyond the sanction stage?
Those motivations depend on which NATO members you're talking about, and that, unfortunately, is, I think, a position of weakness for the alliance. There are NATO members who have a lot more on the line economically when it comes to confronting Russia directly. And again, we must say that Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so there is no NATO obligation to come to the defense of Ukraine because Ukraine is not a member. President Obama made clear that that obligation is ironclad, and that was especially a message to be heard in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. But since Ukraine is outside the NATO alliance, there is no binding obligation. That makes it easier for Europeans who depend on Russia for natural gas supplies to heat their homes in the winter, for example, or members of the NATO alliance who have arms contracts with Russia to be reluctant to get a tougher line with President Putin beyond some of these economic sanctions.
VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has put forward what he called an action plan for peace in eastern Ukraine amid contradictory reports on whether a ceasefire had been reached between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatist rebels. Speaking in the Mongolian capital of Ulaanbaatar, Mr. Putin said both the Ukrainian government forces and the rebels should halt active offensive operations in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions of eastern Ukraine, where the two sides have engaged in fierce clashes, and that the government forces should withdraw to a distance from which they cannot hit populated areas with artillery and other volley fire weapons, as he put it. The Russian leader also urged full-fledged and objective international control over ceasefire compliance, a ban on the use of military aviation against civilian areas, an unconditional prisoner exchange, the opening of humanitarian corridors for the movement of refugees and relief supplies, and the possibility of sending in teams to repair damaged infrastructure. Ukraine and NATO say Russian troops and armor have crossed the border in recent days, forcing the retreat of Ukrainian units which had been gaining ground against the rebels. Moscow denies its armed forces are involved in the fighting. Earlier Wednesday, the office of Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said he and Mr. Putin had agreed in a phone conversation on a permanent ceasefire. But Mr. Poroshenko's office subsequently revised that statement to say mutual understanding was reached on steps that will contribute to establishing peace without giving any details. Russia's RIA Novosti state agency on Wednesday quoted a spokesman for the defense ministry of the separatist self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, Vladislav Brig, as saying there could be no ceasefire as long as Ukrainian government forces remain in the Donbas, the section of eastern Ukraine that includes the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. NATO estimates at least 1,000 Russian troops are in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly denied any military presence on Ukrainian territory. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is International Edition. President Obama says the beheading of an American journalist by Islamic State militants was a horrific act of violence. Speaking to reporters Wednesday in Estonia, Mr. Obama said those who killed Stephen Sotloff have failed in whatever they're trying to achieve because the United States and the world are repulsed by their barbarism and will not be intimidated. The Associated Press reports that Israel has revealed that Sotloff, the victim of the attack, also held Israeli citizenship. A statement early Wednesday from the National Security Council said U.S. intelligence agencies analyzed a video showing Sotloff's killing and judged it to be real. A spokesman for Sotloff's relatives said the family is aware of the video and is grieving privately. The extremist Islamic State group released the video Tuesday in which a black-masked militant with a British accent addresses Mr. Obama, saying Sotloff's death is retaliation for U.S. airstrikes against the group in Iraq. The killing apparently was carried out in a similar manner to the beheading last month of American journalist James Foley. British Prime Minister David Cameron called Sotloff's murder disgusting and despicable. The United States has been conducting airstrikes against the Islamic State in coordination with Iraq's government since early August. Sotloff was taken captive in Syria in August of 2013, about a year after Foley was abducted. He worked for Time and Foreign Policy magazines. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Tuesday the U.S. will continue airstrikes to disrupt Islamic State's ability to put U.S. personnel and facilities at risk. He said the airstrikes also will support humanitarian aid to those persecuted by the extremists. Somalia's government has welcomed the drone strike that targeted leaders of the militant group al-Shabaab. The U.S. military says it targeted al-Shabaab's number one commander, Ahmed Abdi Godane, but it is not yet confirmed whether he was killed. Abdulaziz Bilo has more for VOA from Mogadishu.
Hours after the U.S. claimed responsibility for an airstrike against the al-Shabaab leadership, authorities in the capital, Mogadishu, held an urgent cabinet meeting to discuss the latest security operations. After the meeting, the officials said they welcomed the drone strike. Government spokesman Ridwan Haji Abdiweli told reporters that the government supports any operations against the militant group. He said the target of this operation were the key commanders of the al-Shabaab. Such attacks will continue, he said, because it's only the Somali government that has the authority to govern this nation and not terrorist groups like the al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has neither confirmed nor denied reports that its top leader, Abdi Ahmed Godane, was killed in the attack. If confirmed, his death will be a serious setback for al-Shabaab. At least six people were reportedly killed in the drone strike, which took place in Sablale, an agricultural town in southern Somalia. The town is 60 kilometers from Barawe, the last remaining al-Shabaab bastion in southern Somalia and a key port for the group. African Union forces in Somalia recently launched an offensive codenamed Operation Indian Ocean. This operation is aimed at seizing ports from al-Shabaab and cutting off crucial sources of revenue. General Abdirizak Khalif Ilmi is Deputy Chief of Defense of the Somali National Army. He says that the operation will dislodge al-Shabaab from many parts of the country and return normalcy to areas they have controlled. Just as the Somali population has taken up arms against al-Shabaab, he says, we want to work together because we have the right to live like everyone else in the world and for children to live in peace and freedom. Al-Shabaab has lost control of the many cities and towns it once controlled, but still carries out major attacks in Mogadishu. It has attacked the presidential palace twice this year and killed six members of parliament. The U.S. government has designated Godane as a terrorist and 2 years ago offered up to $7 million for information that brings him to justice. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA, Mogadishu.
A British nurse infected with Ebola has been released from the hospital after recovering from the virus. The Royal Free London Hospital said Wednesday William Pooley's 10 days of treatment did include the experimental drug ZMapp. He was taken to the hospital last month after contracting Ebola while working in Sierra Leone. An Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed more than 1,500 people and infected at least 3,000 this year in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Senegal. A director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control warns the Ebola outbreak in West Africa will worsen in coming weeks significantly. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Dr. Tom Frieden says a massive global response is needed now to combat what he calls the world's first Ebola epidemic.
Dr. Frieden, who just returned from the most affected West African countries of Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, says despite tremendous efforts by healthcare workers, the number of Ebola cases continues to increase rapidly. Speaking at CDC headquarters in Atlanta, Frieden says the number of cases, now more than 3,000, are expected to increase rapidly in coming weeks.
There is a window of opportunity to tamp this down, but that window is closing. We need action now to scale up the response.
Frieden says this is the first epidemic of Ebola the world has ever known.
It's spreading from just two roots: people caring for other people in hospitals or homes, and unsafe burial practices where people may come in contact with body fluids of someone who's died from Ebola. That is really the Achilles heel of this virus. We know how it spreads. We know how to stop it from spreading. The challenge is to do that everywhere that's needed.
Frieden warns the number of Ebola cases is rising so rapidly that each day's delay in responding to it makes it more difficult to stop it from spreading. The CDC director says what is needed is a major inflow of resources, technical experts, and a global, coordinated, unified approach, because this is, he says, not just an African problem, but a global problem. A similar message was conveyed to the United Nations Tuesday. Joanne Liu, president of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, said the world is losing the battle to contain Ebola. She calls the virus a transnational threat.
Riots are breaking out. Isolation centers are overwhelmed. Health workers on the front lines are becoming infected and are dying in shocking numbers. Others have fled in fear, leaving people without care for even the most common illnesses. Entire health system have crumbled.
Liu said isolation centers are now reduced to places where people go to die alone, where little more than palliative care is offered. David Nabarro, the British physician who has been designated the UN's system coordinator on Ebola and also visited West Africa, said every nation must ask what it can do to help.
Because if we don't get on top of this outbreak as a global community, then this could affect all of us in unexpected ways. It's not somebody else's problem. It's our collective problem.
Before leaving for Europe, President Obama videotaped a message to West Africans.
On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola.
Mr. Obama sought to dispel myths surrounding the spread of Ebola, saying infection only comes through contact with someone or something infected by the virus or the body fluids of someone who has died of Ebola.
That's why the disease is continuing to spread where patients are being cared for at home or during burials when families and friends lay their loved ones to rest.
He said people can respect their traditions and honor their loved ones without risking the lives of the living. The president said stopping the disease will not be easy, but it can be done cooperatively. U.S. health officials Tuesday announced a federal contract with California-based MAP Biopharmaceuticals to speed development of ZMAP, an experimental drug that has yet to go through extensive human testing, but has been rushed into use despite its limited availability. Two American missionaries working in Liberia who contracted Ebola were given the drug and have recovered from their illnesses. One of those healthcare workers, Dr. Kent Bradley, told NBC Television Tuesday he was not sure he would survive.
I don't think they ever said, Kent, I think you're about to die, but I felt like I was about to die. And I said to the nurse who was taking care of me, I'm sick, I have no reserve, and I don't know how long I can keep this up.
Brantley, who has been released from Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, said he is in tearful prayer for yet another American doctor, identified only as a male obstetrician, who has contracted Ebola in Liberia. He has isolated himself since the symptoms appeared. All three Americans, including Nancy Reitbol, work for the North Carolina-based SIM International Mission. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
There is a new study out that says the growing popularity of the Western diet could help worsen climate change. As more people make meat a principal part of their diet, the authors of this study say it will be very difficult to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. More from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The global population is forecast to grow to over 9 billion by 2050. And as the population rises, so does the need for more food. The demand for meat is rising especially fast in many of the world's emerging economies. The Western diet has become fashionable there. Many studies have warned that the Western diet, filled with fat, sugar, and salt, is triggering more non-communicable diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and obesity. But the new study, published in Nature Climate Change, considers the health of the planet, not just the body. Co-author Chris Gilligan is professor of mathematical biology at the University of Cambridge. He says much of the study focuses on how greater food production will affect land use.
Well, that's going to be one of the major problems as we go forward. That has knock-on consequences then on conservation, on biodiversity, but also on use of land for other purposes, for urbanization, for example, for energy supply and how we manage water. How do we find enough land to produce the crops for crop growth, the crops that are then used to feed animals, and also regions for rearing the animals?
The study says using more land for food production carries a high price. Deforestation, for example, would result in greater carbon emissions.
First of all, we think about where is that new land for agriculture going to come from? And a lot of it is going to come from pristine forests. So as you remove those forests, you're removing trees, which are very important traps for carbon dioxide. And in deforestation, there's an increase in greenhouse gas emissions.
Gilligan says greater food production also will result in more methane being released into the atmosphere.
Increasing livestock production also involves a large amount of greenhouse gas production from the animals themselves.
Methane would also be released through the use of manure as fertilizer. The study says increased deforestation, fertilizer use, and methane from livestock are likely to cause greenhouse gas emissions from food production to increase by nearly 80%. Gilligan says what people choose to eat is a major driver behind greenhouse gas emissions.
For many people, meat does taste exciting. It tastes different. You can do lots of things with it in a culinary way, as one can with vegetables, of course. But nevertheless, there is an attraction there, an attraction in saying, well, yes, I eat a lot more meat than I used to.
The study also says that food production is a main driver of biodiversity loss and pollution. The Cambridge professor says reducing greenhouse gas emissions could involve persuading people to eat differently. But he adds it won't be easy.
There may be economic means by which this is done, for example, through a carbon tax, but that's a punitive measure and may perhaps be necessary. More preferable, however, is the notion of the nudge approach to behavior. So how do you make it attractive for people to change their dietary behavior? That is about publicity, about the health advantages, and hoping that that really induces people to change what they do.
Reducing waste during food production, he says, would go a long way toward lowering pollution.
There is a huge amount of loss of material through waste in developing countries pre-harvest and in developed countries, sadly, post-harvest. Were we able to move to a reduction in, for example, waste, that could have a significant reduction in that amount of greenhouse gas emission.
The UN Environment Program estimates one-third of the food produced for human consumption every year gets lost or wasted. That's about 1.3 billion tons of food that nobody gets to eat. The UNEP says in the U.S. alone, 30% of all food is thrown away. The study goes on to say the Western diet is characterized by an excessive consumption of food. Researchers came up with what they call an average balanced diet that would reduce pressure on the environment. It includes 2 85-gram portions of red meat and 5 eggs per week, along with a daily portion of poultry. They say it's not about being vegetarian, it's about eating sensibly while protecting the environment. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you so much for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks for joining us.
Stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.